we're excited about this. You guys must spend a fortune.
You know, the underbelly that actually exists. Yeah.
I really would prefer more action and fewer reports.
Well, NIMBY, not in my backyard, but what we heard in the task force was NIMBY has become so bad.
At that time, I feel like we were really focused on bringing in people that were tradespeople that were building our province.
Holy cats, they go through this regulatory ringer, the circus descends, the lawyers get involved, the NIMBYs all come to council. We will, you know, give advice to any political party on how to get more homes built.
Canadian Bank on track to make almost $10 billion in profit, right?
The definition of government is why let a really good outcome get in the way of a really long process.
Okay, so Realty, we're excited about this, the conference.
Yes,
the Ottawa
yes.
conference, yeah? You guys must spend a fortune putting this thing on.
It's an investment, but it's worth it.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, we have a number of things, right? We, the ticket prices are I think, very reasonable for what you're getting, which helps pay the cost. Sponsorship's really high too. We're almost $500,000 in sponsorship for this event, right? Which really helps to defray the grants and bring in exciting speakers. And then yeah, RIA does help with these events too, because we believe in the platform. It is the best place to see where real estate is going. Extraordinary networking and helps keep the profile high to get things done when it comes to advocacy.
ORIA's got to be the largest real estate board by far in Canada, right?
We are, I saw in, let's say, Korea, because we're part of Korea, right? But we are the largest real estate association in Canada. We're about 100,000 realtors in every big city, small city, village across Ontario. Any guesses, Narcus, where we are in North America?
Fourth.
You nailed it.
Oh, really?
You nailed it.
So California, New York, Florida.
Yeah.
I don't know the other one, Illinois, like Chicago.
Good guess is actually Texas.
Oh, wow.
Texas, California, Florida, they're ahead of us for number four. And it's funny when I go in the States, because I, you know, try to network there. I'm sure you agree, Mark, saw the trends that happen in the States, eventually come to Canada. So I get to look down the road a little bit. And they'll say, oh, you're from Ontario. Is that Ontario, California? How big are you guys? They'll say 100,000 numbers. What? Ontario, California? No, it's a place in Canada called Ontario. But we are the fourth largest in anywhere in North America.
So ORIA's job is what?
There's really two big functions. Number one, for the realtor members, we're there. We have their back. We do the standard forms. We do advanced education once you get out of your licensing. We do the leadership and help with our local member boards as well. And for realtors who want to invest in their skills to be volunteer leaders. So they're big parts of what we do. And then guidance. There's some new legal ruling. There's new legislation. How do you make that work for your business? That's the big part of the job. Mm-hmm. And then number two is advocacy. So being the voice for realtors and the women, men, and families that they're busting their butts for each and every day. That's a lot of interaction at the provincial level. Really, Mark is focused on two things, getting more homes built to help create that next generation of Canadian homeowners. And then number two on that list, raising the bar. When it comes to professional standards, education, consumer protection, we want to make sure the realtor at your side when you're making the biggest financial decision of your life has the highest professional standards anywhere in North America.
That's great. And I can't wait to talk about getting homes built. Perb has really more people using that as a mandate. The more people, the better. Using that as their mandate, right?
Say it's fun. You enjoy your job. You've been very successful, great entrepreneur. I bet when you get up every day, right, you're excited to be helping out people, you know, get in the market, help with their investments, all that. For me, it is really motivating when the feet hit the floor in the morning, that you're working every day and helping create that next generation of Canadians who own a home. It's inspiring. When I was in politics, that was always a big drive of me. How do we create more homeowners, stronger neighborhoods? And now each and every day working for our realtors that help connect people with a great place to call home. It is a very invigorating way to go through your career when you're championing homeownership, and we're making progress.
You've got a great team.
Yeah, the team's outstanding. I've been really lucky to attract people from whether the real estate world, from the politics world, you know, other associations working in harmony. They're also attracted very much by the mission, right? This, any conversation you have, you're the neighborhood barbecue, you got a cocktail party at your house, you're at Timmy's, it really comes down to housing, right? The big question, my daughter did everything right. She got her degree. She got a good job. Love her dearly, but right. I want her out of the basement and to find a place of her own. So when you're working every day, my team and I, working with the realtor leaders, that's a really inspiring way to start your day. And you feel good about it when you put your head in the pillow at the end of the day. When I retired from 21 years in politics to take the job as CEO of Aria, my daughters didn't quite know what that meant. They heard of Aria and they thought it was the cookie company, right? I'm no surprise. It had to be like 7 or 4 at the time. And when I did that, I bought a new home in North Toronto, Yonge and Lawrence. And I had this great video I keep on my phone of my daughters dancing in the open, you know, living room area in front of the window. So excited to have a bigger home, excited about the rooms, all that stuff. And my little one said, now, Daddy, I understand what you do. You help people who help families like us get a new home.
Wow.
Really touching moment. Yeah, it still gives me a little teary-eyed.
It's so cute, right? They're so sweet, especially at that age, right? Like this age if they're growing up.
Yeah. And it beat the cookie company. That's something more important than the
maybe. I mean, like you had this great team around you. You guys seem to be getting a whole bunch done. You were talking about even like a plan for your members. So like a…
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So
as I said earlier, a big part of our public-facing job, number one, getting more homeowners, right? Making beds. It's been the social fabric that's made Canada strong. The chance if you work hard, save up your money, you can get ass. Number two, the partner on that is the highest professional standards and support for realtors anywhere in North America. We did that in two ways, Marcus. 23 was an outstanding year. Number one, we got in the new legislation. Happy to talk about that. The Trust and Real Estate Services Act. It's called TRESA. It had been 20 plus years since there was new legislation. So that catapults Ontario to the top of the list in North America when it comes to professionalism, code of ethics, a strong enforcement of people who break the rules to get them out of profession altogether, and new business tools for realtors like personal real estate corporations. And alongside
that was huge for a lot of real estate agents, right?
Yeah.
Changing the way they get paid.
Yeah. Maybe we can come back to that. I'm sure
I'd love to talk about that.
Yeah. So that was sort of the A lane on how we're raising the bar for to become North America leaders. And the second one was, how do we have the back of our members? How do we be there when times get tough? And we certainly saw a big swing in the market this past year compared to a couple of years ago. And when we surveyed our members, Marcus, we found out that 60% had no healthcare coverage whatsoever. So 40% didn't even have life insurance. So they're out there every day doing the best for their clients, focused on the job, but they're walking on a tightrope with no safety net to catch them. So our board of directors, as Stacey Eboy was a president at the time, and Tanya Artinozzi said, let's create a safety net, a basic health and insurance package to have the back of our members.
Fantastic.
And that did pass. It started January 1, and we're the first in North America.
Good for you.
It is actually amazing.
It's hard, right? Because a lot of these, like typically real estate agents are like entrepreneurs, right? Like they're kind of gunslingers. They're, you know, eat what you kill. And they don't have this backstop for themselves. And especially in a time like the last year when the market turned and there weren't as many transactions.
Part of what we heard from members was in the mental health side. Right? There was no support there. It can be very stressful. You've got to be strong and have, you know, be there for your clients who are going through extreme mental health stress while you yourself may be suffering or somebody from your family. And part of this package is 24/7 access to healthcare providers online through Maple. We got that.
Yeah, I heard about mental health support. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So when you see that our members are actually now tapping into that, seeing a doctor within 8 minutes, getting mental health support or physical support, it makes you feel good. Now, this was controversial. We had some people, like you said, the entrepreneurs, I don't need this. I'm on my own. If I want to buy my insurance, I can. But we also had some people like the woman I met who, 3 kids, single mom, loves real estate, and her son has drug bills and she's struggling to make ends meet. I said, thank God that you guys brought this program in because now I can supply this for my family and I can stay in the profession I love.
It's too bad the healthcare system didn't work well enough so that you wouldn't have to use Maple or, you know,
yeah. And maybe we'll solve that problem someday.
Here today.
Solve it today. But in the meantime, it feels really good despite all of the hard work to get here that we could not find another profession, an association anywhere in North America, whether that was, you know, real estate or it was the accountants or what have you, that had that basic health and wellness plan for their members. And if people pay for it through the dues, if they want to have more coverage, like for a spouse, for family, they want to increase the package, they can do so. Awesome. Happy to see it launch.
Okay. Change lanes.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you something.
Sure.
I think I listened to a podcast that you were on.
Uh-huh.
And I gleaned from it that before you got into politics, you had a couple of jobs. And one of them was working at the Peace Bridge.
Yes.
And I guess that's pretty convenient, right? Like you live in Fort Erie. You grew up in Fort Erie.
You got it.
And the bridge is right there.
Yeah.
So you get a job. And are you working for like Customs and Border Control?
You got it. I was a customs agent there. Yeah, I worked there as a summer student when I was going to university, which helped pay the tuition bills. Also, it was just really interesting to learning about people and some of the, you know, the underbelly that actually exists, you know, out there. And then I did it a year full time before I went back to school to do my master's degree in economics. So, you know, I like the joke that I would, a big part of my job was finding drugs or weapons and keeping nefarious characters outside of Canada. And don't worry, Marcus, I won't talk about the economy. We had that record of seal for another 20 years.
thank you very much, actually, for that.
See, I kept the quiet.
So, did you guys ever like deal with the counterparts in the States? Or was it you would just like, you know what I mean? Like the people that are leaving Canada going to the States would deal with the American side. And the people that come into Canada, obviously dealing with the Canadian customs. Would you guys liaise together? Like, would there be...
Yeah, some. There probably should be more, but some. You know, by way of example, if there was a threat to the bridge, like a bomb threat, all that kind of stuff, of course you work together. If you're trying to compare notes on when somebody came or left the country, you can get that data to ascertain when did they leave, what vehicle. If there were alerts, this is one of the sad things that we dealt with back in my time on the border, was when Paul Bernardo was loose, killing young women, right?
Yeah.
So alerts, we didn't know who it was at the time, what kind of car. High security, things like that. You share that information.
You were working at the border while that was going on?
Yeah, I remember we used to have alerts for
suspects. Nobody knew who it was.
Yes, yeah, right.
We knew the girls had disappeared. So there would be a report that, you know, a white van was a suspicious vehicle. So we search it and pull it over. And we communicate that with the Americans as well. And other things like, it's not instant. So if you went over to buy a case of beer, the Americans aren't going to rat you out.
You got to pay your taxes.
They focus on the really serious stuff that I talked about.
So, when people were entering, you'd be there in the basically like a toll booth kind of thing. And you would ask them,
yep,
do you have anything to declare?
Yep.
And then you would have to identify whether or not that person was lying to you.
Yep.
So you got pretty good at picking out if you
were lying. I was pretty good at it. Yeah. Well, I don't know if this is
worth bragging about. To me, it is. So they actually kept stats of how many, you know, vehicles did you seize, the contraband and stuff like that. And believe it or not, I actually led the port for a couple years in a row when I was a summer student in catching those people. This other guy who eventually became a cop, Dave Henderson was his name. He and I were kind of, and Tim Trotway, that's right, the three of us, two guys became cops. I got into politics, who were particularly good at it. But yeah, it's reading people, does the story add up? It's a carotid artery that's beating. A big mistake people have. I could probably write a book on how to smuggle. If you they'll grab the steering wheel like the white knuckle type stuff, the night look really calm. Hey, how's it going? But their knuckles are like this. Another tell is that people do this. How long have you been away? 24 hours. Did you buy anything? No. Any alcohol? No. But what they're doing is they're looking at the highway
because they're subconscious saying, I got to get out of here. I'm nervous.
So that's another tell in terms of how they react. I'll tell you another quick story on another one.
Yeah.
This didn't happen to me, but it was when I was working. It was a classic story. Guy's going through and he's smoking a cigarette and he's being very casual with the officer. Looks very relaxed and everything right. And at the end of the conversation, he's ready to go up the highway. He basically takes out his Bic lighter, lights up a smoke, and then tosses the Bic lighter out the window.
That was amazing.
Exactly. So the very last minute, his mind sort of screwed up, pulled over, and he had like all kinds of cartons of cigarettes hidden, you know, behind the back seat and the panels and stuff like that.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So it's all towns. So it's like poker.
Well, I can tell you that anytime I've smuggled anything over the border, I have been much calmer, cooler, and more collected. No, I'm just kidding. Kind of. Am I kidding or not?
Say that again, sorry.
Am I kidding or not?
Well, like I said, there's some things can't talk about. Records are sealed for Christmas.
But it was an enjoyable job and it was an important job. I'm happy to see now that they're focusing more on the security issues, the weapons, the human smuggling, keeping bad people out.
Yeah.
As opposed to being the grocery police.
Yeah. So then you kind of, I mean, you had a couple of jobs and you get into politics young, 27 years old.
27.
Crazy. And you get elected right away.
For any time? Yeah, it's I get invited to talk sometimes at college, university, classes or high school classes, and I talk about sort of the three lessons of success. And but Marcus, you'll have your similar list for your success. But
luck.
No, I'm just kidding.
Well, a bit of that, right?
Number one for me.
But number one on my list is to take chances, to be the person that puts their hand up when they're looking for something to step forward for the tough job. Step forward, because even if you fail, you're going to learn something from it, and you impress those you had the courage to step forward and take a shot. And sometimes luck plays a role. So I said, you know, 95, I ran for office. I wasn't going to win. My riding had not voted for my party, which was the Progressive Conservative Party since before I was born. But I put my hand up. I said, I'm actually a run, I'll lose, but I'll learn something. And then maybe I'll get a job as a policy advisor for a minister or premier. I thought the party was going to win and I would lose. But it was really a lot of fate. I was at the right place at the right time. I had the courage to carry the blue flag, and I won by a squeaker my first time out. I got like 38% of the vote, 1,200 votes.
Yep.
Difference. So it's a combination of the courage to stand up, be at the right place at the right time. And then after that, I worked really hard, worked my tail off, developed a good reputation for delivering, kept track of my database, right, my network. And the next election, I won by 6,000 votes and then 12,000 votes. Anyway, 6 straight elections.
Amazing. So my question was, your wife is politically affiliated. Like,
yes.
She was with Mike Harris, who's probably one of my favorite politicians of all time. He was so charming and, you know, always a good statesman, I think.
Good. Right? Yeah. Well, and a friendly guy too. So you've talked about there, right? He has no, you know, heirs. He's a very successful premier, but very down to earth. That was one of those things that made him a great leader and very connected. He was a leader when I was elected, and I was honored he put me in a cabinet. Well, I'm not connecting to the real estate world. I was a consumer minister when we brought in the Real Estate and Business Brokers Act back in 2000. That was my baby. And then now at ARIA, I had the chance to, you know, take it to the next level with Teresa. You mentioned Debbie. Yeah, I met my wife Debbie through politics. It's funny, we both were at Western at the same time, but never crossed paths.
You never met her when you were at school?
Not that, no.
You were partying and she was studying.
Probably the other way around. She was one of Premier Harris's top advisors. And so I saw this very, very attractive, hot, smart, successful, powerful woman who was always in the big briefings with the premier. I said, I'd like to meet her. And I remember flirting with her at some parties. I was single at the time. And then she moved on to the private sector. And then later on, Debbie actually called me for a date through mutual friends. I thought, this is fantastic because I used to flirt with you and reply to this party and like that. And she had zero recollection of me ever talking to her. I made no impression in those early days. So I'm like, well, I remember talking to you. It's like, oh my God, I can visualize it.
Tim who?
Yeah, kind of. Tim, Tom, I wasn't sure exactly. But that's the story. So I knew her in professional capacity, hit on her.
Made no impact.
How great.
But then years later, we
got. Like, how great is that?
It's kind of funny.
And the other thing I think is great about it is I think it's like, I mean, I'm not going to give marital advice, right? Like, but it's so great when your wife understands what you're doing, right? And can collaborate with you. Look, there's no way you could be successful in anything, let alone something like a big job, like, you know, running the provincial Conservative Party or running ARIA without that support. And then her ability to communicate that to your kids, right? To make sure that everyone's on the same team. I think that for sure, that's got to be part of your success, right? Like it's...
Oh yeah, for sure.
I know it is zero odd than that.
Maybe it wouldn't be anywhere
without Debbie's strong support and wise advice, because she actually was in politics longer than I was, truthfully. It's you gave good advice, Marcus, to anybody in terms of spouse and career, especially if you're an entrepreneur, you're taking some chances. One of my jobs when I was leader of the PC party is to try to recruit good quality candidates, people who are successful in various walks of life, whether that's in business or law enforcement. And when I'd have to sit down, kind of like I am with you, one of my top pieces of advice was you have to have a supportive spouse. You're going to put the whole family in the spotlight. When you go out for dinner with the kids, people are going to come up and talk to you. You'll be away for long periods of time. You become a public figure as opposed to private. And if you don't have that kind of supportive spouse when you take the leap, you're not going to be successful.
One more thing, and then I want to dive into the housing stuff.
Sure, yeah.
And I just thought of this one. Like, I was actually talking to my mom this morning when I was considering early.
How's your mom doing?
She's great. She's great. She's the sweetest woman in the entire world. She I guess she works for the provincial government. She has since I was a kid. She's on a tribunal for labor, like an Ontario
Labor Relations Board.
Yeah. And initially she worked, when I was a kid, she worked for the Ministry of Labor under the Office of the Worker Advisor. But she'll never leave. She just, she doesn't even care what a dollar is. She just, all she is concerned about is helping workers and people who are misrepresented, like doesn't care about politics, doesn't care about anything. And always we get excited when, because there's a formality on this tribunal where I guess the Minister of Labor has to appoint you each time as a tribunal. So like we'll get a voicemail of the answer sheet at home, and it'll be like, you know, whoever the Minister of Labor at that time is calling to leave a message. Like, boys, listen. Like, I remember that when I was a kid. Anyways, well, good.
Thank her for her public service.
Yeah.
That says remarkable to have a person like that that wants to give back throughout her career. And that ain't easy because those are highly desired jobs. The fact that your mom keeps getting reappointed,
right,
that shows that she's doing some really incredible work. So I tell you, the people that want those jobs instead, so she's been rewarding for quality by different stripes of government. That's a real tribute to her character.
And I do actually, because I host Sunday dinners now at my house. Yeah. So basically I'm in charge of making dinner every Sunday night for her, which is my way of thanking for, you know, the public service. So there you go. Anyway, so talking to my mom on the way here, and I said, I really liked him. Like, I've met him a couple of times. She's like, yeah, he's a great guy. I've never met him, but just, you know, you can tell he really cares what he's doing. And I said, I think that politically, where he got into trouble was at the intersection of politics and reality, because he sees what reality is and he realized that there was this level of bloat in provincial government. It exists in municipal government. It exists anywhere where you can somehow, I'm allowed to say this stuff, you probably can't, but it exists anywhere where you remove a level of accountability and you, I don't want to say motivate largesse, but you are complacent with it. And organizations are kind of predisposed, if there isn't a bottom line that's holding them really accountable, they're kind of predisposed to the bloat. And you had what I think would have been extremely beneficial for us as a province. You had an idea to remove a certain layer of bureaucracy, of bloat within the provincial infrastructure. And the opposition took it and kind of turned it all around and turned it into politics. It was a perfect intersection of like, here's a business guy, right? Who came up with a real good business case. Like if you were to do a white paper on what someone, like if you hired McKinsey to do a white paper on what you should do with the government, that would probably be like action item number one. And you positioned it and you got barbecued for it, right? Like the liberals turned it around into this, like, Tammy Hudak wants to fire everybody, right? And then that translated into votes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a, you followed very closely. I'm flattered. Appreciate you saying that, because that was the plan. We actually had a white paper to say, what should the size and cost of government be? And what businesses should government be in? And what businesses should be the private sector's realm? And in those days, we're running huge deficits. We're borrowing against your three sons' future, my daughter's future, right? Just to keep a bloated government going. And whether we pay a price for being honest about it, I am happy to say that a lot of policies I stood for, though, got implemented. Like, you know, by way of example, should government be running casinos? Or should the government play a role in regulating that area, keeping honest players in and kicking bad actors out? And it was actually the Liberal government that criticized policy that brought that in, right? We're now out of the casino business. It's run by private operators and we regulate. Do we have to go only to the LCBO or the beer store to buy a bottle of wine?
Yeah, you had corner stores too. That was part of your platform.
Now it's happening. So I wish I had been the one that get that done, but I feel good that I had the courage to raise those issues and happy to see that those ideas are now getting.
It's too many reports and white papers and documents. Like, I think it's just still too much paper being created, which is a perfect transition into talking about housing. So the Housing Affordability Task Force comes out with essentially a white paper.
It, that's right? Exactly, like, it was.
Right?
Yeah.
And to which the Ontario government responds with another white paper, like another document outlining what their initiatives are going to be in order to address the initial document that was created. And then Oria comes out with another white paper, which essentially comments on the provincial government's like success in implementing its objectives. A lot of paperwork, right? I think we're going in the right direction, right? And I think I agree with a lot of what the Oria report says, because it's kind of based, it's based in more fact than some of the other stuff. I think that we got to identify the challenges, which is a really important kind of part in this whole process. But the thing that initially caught me off is just like how much paper it all is to get to this point of like, of action, which we're really not even there yet. We're almost there, but like, it's like, and that's what's like, that's probably why I can't be in politics, right? Like, because I really would prefer to have kind of more action immediately and fewer reports. And I wanted to ask you, before we get into discussing the reports and what's in the reports, if that ever frustrated you, or if you were kind of prepared, because you got to do it when you're 27 and you kind of desensitized to all of it and you've managed to figure out how to negotiate and navigate through it.
Yeah, a bit of a mixed on that. And then we'll come back to the Housing Affordability Task Force. But I had an expression that definition of government is, you know, why let a really good outcome get in the way of a really long process, right? Like if there's why decide today what you can put off till tomorrow? So it's going to be a cameo process.
That's actually the process that some of the guys that work for me.
there you go. Well, Stephen, future in politics. So because governments...
you can have them.
Sometimes they want to consult broadly, and sometimes we get cold feet and overcomplicate matters. So it's true. But at the same time, you can get a lot done. Like, I'll give an example of that. So I happen to be tourism minister at the time of 9/11. And that was terrible for whether Americans, Canadians that were killed. And from a tourism point of view, you might remember everything shut down. Nobody was flying. The borders were closed. And our tourism operators in Ontario said, what the heck are we going to do? We're going to lose a lot of jobs and close down a lot of doors. So I did a quick consultation. I brought in tourism leaders, whether it's in Toronto, Niagara Falls, Ottawa, Northern Ontario. And we sat around a table, did a couple of meetings. And I said, what do we need to get done? And then I moved. I moved fast. And then we had an action plan that I took it to the premier and to cabinet to, do more ads in tourism. We studied what the Americans were thinking. We realized that they were looking for a friend. So I actually used Shania Twain, Come On Over, Come On In, that song, and targeted really people who were going to fly, but to border states, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, the rubber tire, gave them discounts to come back in Canada, and rejuvenated Canadians and traveling, and we had an impact. So yeah, there's a bit of process at the beginning. But then we got some really good ideas, people who actually run the businesses and put them in action.
Amazing.
Yeah, it worked out well, considering the circumstances we were in.
Then you had to move quickly because you were really kind of addressing that immediate need. So hopefully without you in government, we can move quickly on some of these action items that also require.
And sometimes you got to keep the pressure on. That's the role that ARIA is playing. So you mentioned Mark is the Housing Affordability Task Force. I had the honor of sitting on that task force. And, often with task force, they'll meet for months on end. They'll produce like a Britannica encyclopedia volume, right? They announce at a big press conference that it goes and sits on a shelf somewhere and gathers dust. This one was the opposite. We moved quickly. It was really within a month of the time that we got together to the time our report was issued. It is a short, direct, to the point document that lays out the steps needed to get 1.5 million homes built so we'd have more Canadian homeowners. I think it was brilliantly done. And it was it really caught how average people were thinking about this issue and point out who's falling behind. So the government said they were going to accept all the recommendations. And it's now been 2 years. It was February of 2022. Mm-hmm. So I did a press conference a couple weeks ago at Queen's Park to say, what's the progress report? And that helps put pressure on government that they did. The good news is, though, the 55 recommendations we had, 76% have either been implemented or at least are underway. When it comes to government, that's a very good grade. Now, there are a number of recommendations not yet done. So I said, here are the things that we really need to do to actually get those homes built. Here's what's left in the report that we should get done in 2024. And the biggest part of that, Marcus, was spine, to have the steel to make the tough decisions to get it done. My overall message, bold actions, that's what's required to build the rest of those firms.
I just feel so, and this might not be a popular opinion, I just feel bad for Doug Ford's administration, because in order to have spine, you got to be able to kind of charge forward, and he got hamstrung a little bit with the Greenbelt stuff, which I think like he was going in the right direction on, right? Like he maybe tried to circumvent a few things in order to get things done faster, but he's going in the right direction on things. And I think like if you know Doug and you like, if you followed him, you know where his heart is, right? Like he wants the best for the province, right? Like he is all in on it. Like he could have done anything else. And he takes a beating on a lot of things. Like I have a buddy of mine that's very close to Doug. Dean French, he worked on Doug's campaign. And
on Dean for years.
Yeah. So anecdotally, Dean was like, you know, Doug doesn't eat meat. And I was like, really? Doug won't have a steak. Because of his time working in the slaughterhouses when he was a kid, your dad let him to work there.
Yeah.
To like, to learn about it, right? Like, I want you to learn every piece of, you know, what's going on in our province. I want you to learn about these things. And he saw how the cattle were treated and he's like, I'll never eat this again.
I didn't know that story.
Right. And I feel like more people should know that kind of stuff, right? It gives him a bit of a kind of softer image. In a time when like you think he's this bull in a china shop who doesn't really care and just going to do whatever he wants. It's not the case. And we end up now with a premier who we want Doug Ford to be on his front foot. We don't want him on his back foot because he behaves better. He pushes things through. He's got great ideas. We want him to get in front of things, right? And I think that this objective, this plan, we need to give him more support in order to execute it. So I can't hamstring him because of something that happened with the Greenbelt that I think like in private sector, if you want to get something done, like you want to build houses, you go to the people who build the most houses. And you in public where everything is being critiqued, like, you know, I mean, you went through it. It's really like, Dean French actually calls it, you're marching too far ahead of the parade. He's like, you can't march too far ahead of the parade. You can't get too ahead of it or else you're done.
Yeah.
You're going to be in the parade. But I think that if we could all understand that the reasoning behind why the Greenbelt was kind of evolved, the situation evolved the way it did, was probably just in an effort to get more homes built faster.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? Like, let's get the guys that build the most homes involved in buying the land where the homes need to be built, and let's move forward and let's get it done. Unfortunately, I think that the way that that was viewed in the press is going to impact this, our ability now to move forward as quickly as we should. And that's too bad. And hopefully we can pivot that.
So in speaking with the premier and the housing minister, you've got it right there, Marcus. Like, recognize they messed up the process. The notion of taking land out of the Greenbelt that's not environmentally sensitive, that's right next to housing, putting homes on it, as long as you put even more back into the Greenbelt, right? That makes sense. Bad process around to trip them up, but they still have fire in the belly. They still want to get homes built. They're looking at other ways of doing so. And this report lays out a lot of ideas on how to do that. And the reason I'm optimistic is, the tools are there in the toolbox. You got to have the backbone to use them. But in 21 and 22, we actually built the most homes and the most purpose-built rentals than we've done in like 30 years. So that's a really good head start. We have a lot of catching up to do. We underbuilt for about 20 plus years, but at least we're turning the ship and we're heading in the right direction.
Yeah, the other problem is that you have to fight interest rates, right? Like it's really, the issue here is like, it's not just the malaise with which we approached building for an extended period of time. It's also a really big uphill financial battle because interest rates are so high and building costs are so high. And you addressed that to some extent. So what I really liked about the Oria comments were they were so educated, like they were so based in fact, right? And it's easy, like you issue the press release and the white paper, because it's politics, you have to issue a white paper, but you key in on a few things that will immediately make it cheaper for builders to build, like the wastewater and water being in a municipal corporation, so that they can defer some of the costs to start building, right? We've got the commercial to residential, which is so very much in vogue right now with like office building and different commercial uses not being fully utilized, converting all that into residential utilization along transit corridors, also very, very important, right?
No doubt.
And then there was the exclusionary zoning.
You got it.
Yeah. So all three of these things are so rooted in the here and now, and they're all real concerns. How do you come up with that? Because you're on the task force. You've been involved in that part.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I was there around the table at task force. I was part of all the debates. I was part of the report writing. And so I have a pretty good recollection of what was in there. And then, you know, my staff and I said, okay, let's do a deep dive, 2 years on the progress. I just mentioned 76% are either done or underway. Great. What's left on the table that we can actually get done? And, you know, I'm very motivated by some of these ideas. I've believed them for a long time, whether in politics or in RIA. Now's my chance to push. So you mentioned, Marcus, water and wastewater and allowing long-term financing. So we've successfully built our hydro grid and natural gas by using a long-term financing mechanism, which is user pay across the base, and you pay it over 30 or 40 years, just like you pay down the house. But for some reason, when it comes to water and sewer, we make that the builder, therefore the home buyer, pay it all up front, right off the top. So we're saying change the model and have it financed over a longer time frame, just like natural gas and hydroelectricity. And right there, we believe you can knock off up to $50,000 off the price of a new home.
Yeah.
So they should do that one. Now, it ain't easy, right? There's groups that are opposing that. We've done it this way for forever.
What is the opposition to that?
Some people think that they don't want to have much more growth. You'll have some that are very extreme on the environmental side that just want to bottle everything in. They don't want new neighborhoods. And that.
Your bananas thing was amazing, by the way. Is that yours?
And no, I stole that. But like everybody,
so good.
Like every good politician, a recovering politician, you claim it as your own.
It was so good. I don't know where I listened to you on something else. Yeah, you said bananas, and I was like, "What is banana?"
For those watching me,
you know, NIMBY, not in my backyard. But what we heard in the task force was NIMBY has become so bad that it's now bananas. Build absolutely nothing near anyone at all.
I'm dealing with some bananas.
I believe you.
I own a property in the beaches right now.
So, and that is so. I talk about political courage. NIMBYism is one of the greatest obstacles to getting places built. I will tell you, a lot of NIMBYs have their own home. They're usually pretty well off, and they really don't care if somebody else gets a home, right? That is the biggest obstacle to overcome. A number of the ideas in the paper will help do so, but they will resist. And we need to say to municipalities who will listen to the NIMBYs instead of listening to new residents who want to live in the community or young people who want to stay there and buy a home, reward the municipalities, Marcus, that say yes to new housing. Put their arena project to the top of the list. Support their subway or their new bridge, right? A positive carrot to incent good behavior. And for those municipalities that keep saying no, 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 they don't want new people, they don't want the young people to have a place, then you need to have a stick. They get no funding for their projects. And sometimes it's going to take the province actually to force action if they keep saying no. There is movement that is happening, right? There's movement that is happening, whether in the city of Toronto, whether it's in Hamilton. I was speaking with one of the provincial cabinet ministers the other day, and he's saying, he's a former mayor, and he said, driving crazy that all the boxes would be checked off on a new build happening. The builder met all the rules. They could see new people moving into the area. It would go to council for a vote, and they'd turn it down.
Yeah.
And they go for beer after. I said, look, that met all of our requests. Why did you turn it down? Oh, you know, because Dave and Bob, I like them. They live down the street. They showed up at the meetings, so I couldn't vote for it. You need ways to get over that. I had mentioned earlier by rewarding infrastructure projects for a municipality. I think that the tribunal, when it comes to land approvals, has become too politicized. Let them award costs like the courts.
I just did on that Kingset deal. Did you see that?
Oh, did they now? Good. That's something we've been pushing for some time. That if somebody abuses the process, they should have to pay a pre-legal.
I paid the legals for Kingset's lawyers.
Okay.
which is like, you know, I mean, you don't really want to go down this way, but there has to be some teeth on the other side of it.
It's been abused.
Yeah.
Right? It has been abused. So you need to fix that. And you need to have, in some areas, as of right, to make the development. So if we're building the transit lines that we are, whether that's in Toronto, Mississauga, Hamilton, what have you, there should be, as of right, the ability to build high along those lines.
Right.
It makes no sense to spend all that taxpayer money and have one or two stories like down the Danforth that exists today. You need to build the homes and allow for a density around those transit stations. My last one on this that I pressed at that press conference was getting rid of exclusionary zoning. Mm-hmm. So, you know, picture that wartime bungalow, whether it's in North Toronto, in, you know, Oakville or St. Catharines.
Yeah.
And if the owner today wanted to knock it down to build a four-story monster home, she got that right. We support that. You work hard for your family. You've saved up the money. You should be allowed to do that as long as you meet all the safety standards, of course. But the same owner wanted to knock that house down and build a triplex or a fourplex. Holy cats, they go through this regulatory ringer, the circus descends, the lawyers get involved, the NIMBYs all come to council. And then 2 years later, they're out of pocket, no homes get built. And who pays the price? It's those three or four families that now can't get into the market because the homes don't exist. So we believe that properties like that, you feel build as of right, build up, God bless. But also you want to do the triplex or quadplex, you should be able to do that.
I think it's great. I hope it moves forward. And I think that after we can wrap our heads around the kind of bureaucracy that exists at the municipal level and like the way things are run, like it's broken, the next problem that we have to face, and you addressed it in the housing affordability task force paper, is we don't have the workers. Like we actually, like, there aren't enough people to build the things that we need. And we keep bringing in, we're looking for university educated, we're looking for people that are going to be schooled here. But like, I mean, both my mom and my dad came to Canada. My mom on a boat when she was four with her father, who was in construction from Italy, and my father, you know, on a plane when he was 18. But like, at that time, I feel like we were really focused on bringing in people that were tradespeople that were building our province, our country, right?
You're absolutely right. We did. I mean, to see Niagara, the Welland and Canal, right? That was largely built by people who came from, a lot of Italians came in, right? Germans as well. Built the Welland and Canal, the hydro generation project of the Beck, right? That brings electricity across southern Ontario. You're absolutely right. We need to do two things. Encourage more people, young people, to get into the trades, women and men both. As you know, Mark, as it pays well, you're talking six-figure salaries,
yeah,
benefits, good pension. And anybody watching the Center Renovation Project knows, right?
It's a pretty good job.
Good is working for the provincial government.
So more of that. And you know, I think the provincial government deserves a tip of the hat and a Premier Ford for doing a lot more to make the trades easier to get into and encouraging people to do so. But we're still going to need more people coming in. So in our immigration system, it's hard to get into Canada, right? There's a point system. And we reward university degrees and PhDs and certain language. But how about this? We do not give points for people who have the skilled trades to build the houses and the hospitals, the schools, or the highways we're going to need. So let's change our point system, give them a shot, bring that talent in here to build the homes we're going to need. Both two things, it becomes a skilled trade.
That'd be so great.
Help close that gap.
How do we do that? Like, how do we get that?
So most of that is going to be, I think the provincial government is doing a good job. They're encouraging people in the right direction. Keep going. At the national level, they control immigration policy. They do allow the provinces to have a certain number of people that they can say we want for this industry. Ontario's pointed a lot of those people that they get towards the skilled trades. But the big change has to be at the national level to give points, to give recognition, to make it more targeted towards skilled trades to recognize the big role they play in our modern economy.
I just hope that we can see a big change at the national level politically.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, we'll see where that all goes. And we will, you know, give advice to any political party on how to get more homes built. We hope that they will listen to us. But this one really stands out. And what can the national government do? Change immigration policy to get more skilled trade workers. I think the CMHC could play a better job in helping to finance projects for first-time home buyers, particularly. And the federal government has had interest rates up too high for too long.
You want to know anecdotally something that would immediately reduce interest rates for Canadians?
Shoot.
Something that was removed by Bill Morneau when he was the Minister of Finance and nobody talks about it. I don't know why nobody talks about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, tell me.
So there's something called portfolio insurance. You'll get familiar with the product. No, it was a CMHC product. And it had a $600 billion cap. And it was for mortgage finance companies, read First National, Merrick's Financial, or MCAP. So mortgage lenders who focused on prime mortgage business. This product was rolled out essentially for those lenders to be able to compete with the banks, be able to offer mortgages to Canadians who had greater than 20% equity in their homes.
Okay.
Or were purchasing a home greater than $1 million in value.
Okay.
So it provided access to a marketplace by allowing those lenders to insure their mortgages essentially with the federal government under CMHC's portfolio insurance program. And maybe it cost 20 or 30 basis points. I don't know exactly what the cost okay. was. This product allowed these lenders who do not have a balance sheet, who relied upon the banks for lines of credit to fund these mortgages, to then stamp them with a bond and then sell them out into the open market with an equal rating as a Government of Canada bond. Well, this coincided with the kind of flash real estate crash we had 2008-2009, where the United States was far more heavily impacted.
Yep.
The Canadian government, Minister of Finance, Bank of Canada, opened up the portfolio insurance product to the Canadian banks. And like Scotiabank, for instance, dumped in almost $200 billion worth of their uninsured mortgages.
Really?
Into this bulk portfolio insurance program.
Okay.
And it was in concert with the government. The government said, listen, we need our banks to be stable, right? We don't want Scotiabank to fail. So let's let them dump the $200 million into the portfolio product. And then we'll readdress it because it is capped legislatively, I think. I mean, you know more of kind of those interest gizzies, but it's capped at $600 billion. We'll look at that down the road. Okay? But for now, let's just like focus on stability. So they, at the riskiest time, home values are dropping. So these portfolio insured products are looking shaky. Scotiabank takes the kind of, not the pick of the letter, takes whatever they need to shore up their balance sheet and dumps it into the portfolio insurance product. We get out of the crisis. Property values start rising again. Liberal government comes to us and says, we've reached the cap of the portfolio insurance product. This is November of 2010, I want to say. I might be wrong on the date. Anyways, we reached the cap. And frankly, we feel that the Canadian taxpayer should no longer be responsible for underwriting risky loans. That was the media clip that went out there.
Right.
And everyone rallied behind it. Yeah, why are we underwriting risky loans? What happened the day after? Is it effectively eliminated the ability for mortgage finance companies to compete with the Canadian banks for the business of the safest and wealthiest Canadian consumers, the consumers who had homes that were greater than $1 million or greater than 20% equity in their home.
Right.
And now, in this market today, since that date, you see a discrepancy in the interest rates Canadians pay between conventionally insured CMHC loans and previously what would have fallen under portfolio insurance.
Okay.
Because the Canadian banks just let the dust settle and they said, oh, well, it looks like it costs them like almost a percentage point more to fund these now. So let's increase our rates on the portfolio insurance stuff by another point and clip a little more in their net and then interest margins. And this is why this upsets me. It upsets me because, and I don't know if you've seen our previous shows, but like I was kind of ragging on Loblaws a little bit, right? I thought that when you look at the CPI numbers, there's clearly some greedflation happening by corporations. Like in the States, everywhere, I mean, it's how corporations behave. You know, they see an opportunity, they're going to exploit it. Unfortunately, in Canada, we kind of have, it's done too much in concert with the government, I feel like, at times. So it was ragging on Loblaws. And then the Scotiabank came up with their quarterly numbers.
Okay.
and they had in excess of $2.2 billion in profit. Canadian Bank, one quarter, on track to make almost $10 billion in profit, right? Okay. And this is another reason why I can't go into politics. but I don't care, right? I can say whatever I want. So do you know what the number one line item on that report was?
No.
Net interest margin. The difference between what they pay to their investors, to their deposit holders, the people that give them their deposits, and the rate that they charge the people that are borrowing money from them. So they're successfully navigating the last quarter and previously the number one contributor to their income quarter before that and the quarter before that. Guess what it was? Net interest margins, Ian. Continually increasing. It's the same greedflation that's everywhere else. And you're going to see it from the rest of the banks too. If the federal government could come back in and say, you know what, that portfolio insurance product that we capped
right.
and we got rid of under the auspices of it hurting the Canadian taxpayer, well, we're now starting to realize that maybe 75% of the Canadian taxpayers have a mortgage. And maybe it actually is more beneficial if we can save all of them one percentage point on their mortgages every single year, most of them after tax, instead of a fun media clip. Like, how's that for making housing more affordable?
Yeah,
like that.
I appreciate that perspective where it all came from. And there's no doubt that today we're in a bit of a similar dilemma where at the national level, the federal government is trying to do things to get more homes built, more homeowners, right? They're heading in the right direction. We can talk about that some other time, what they're doing. But then their agencies, whether that's the CMHC, whether that's the Bank of Canada, whether that's OSFI, are pulling in the opposite direction. And you know, Marcus, if you're in a boat and see people rolling this way and see people rolling that way, you're not going to make any kind of progress.
You're going nowhere. Okay, last thing, two more things I want to ask you. Number one, yep. Dan Carter.
Yeah.
The mayor of Oshawa.
Absolutely.
You know him too?
I've known Dan for a long, long time. Real inspiring guy, right?
I'm meeting with him after this.
Oh, great.
Is
he on the show?
Not on the show. I have a project in Oshawa that I'm working on.
Pass on my regards. I've known Dan throughout my time in politics. He was in media. Now, of course, the mayor of Oshawa is on regional council in Durham.
He'd be a great guest for you.
I should get him.
Very
come on
pro-housing
the show, right?
Guy, too.
For sure. And an inspiring story, right? Here's a guy who found
yes.
himself homeless.
Yeah.
Homeless and turned his life around and now is the mayor of Oshawa.
With like an 86 percentage point. He doesn't even care, but with about an 86 percentage point approval rating in Oshawa.
Yeah.
And you know, I told him last time that I was in Oshawa, I told him, I was like, I know why you have that approval rating. It's because every fiber of you is on, like, how am I going to make Oshawa better?
Yeah.
These are my people.
Yeah,
right?
Loves his community, loves the region.
And I say he's a great communicator. And also, he's been there, right? So he's got a perspective of the highs and lows of what happens in people's lives. And it's got a really good focus on how to improve the quality of life in Oshawa.
I think it's easy to be a good communicator if you only have one agenda. Right.
Well, it's
he's got one agenda.
Well, would you invest in a business that they have 100 priorities?
Right.
And government can get caught up in that. And the reason I think Dan's been successful and some others because he's been laser focused on things like, you know, getting more homes built.
Okay. Last thing I want to talk about. Yeah. Funny story.
Sure.
Okay. So I'm reading about you in order to prepare.
Try to fall asleep at night.
Well, no, I'll tell you, like, we don't often have guests on the podcast.
Yeah.
Right. So you are probably our most important guest ever.
Well, I'm glad I get to stick around then.
Maybe, you know what, with the exception of my very good friend, Gene McBurney, who came on here.
Okay.
You guys are on par. Definitely you're above Justin Turner, who co-hosts the show Heavy Soap Dives. Anyways, so I'm reading about you and it comes up that you're on the board of a military boarding school.
Yes.
Robert Land.
Robert Land Academy, yeah. Exactly, in Wellingport.
So it's on my tablet at home mm-hmm. while my wife starts making dinner for the boys. So kind of like I leave it and I, you know, pour a glass of wine and we're making dinner and the boys are kind of like running around. I've told you I have 3 boys, 9, 7, and 5.
Yeah.
And they're all running around, very clever boys. And I guess my 9-year-old sees it on the screen of my tablet, this military boarding school. He doesn't say anything, but I can tell his kind of mood changed. His demeanor changes a little bit at dinner.
Right.
Oscar is his name.
That's a good name.
And we're sitting down at dinner and the behavior just sucks.
Okay.
Like he'd probably been there, right? Like, I mean, they're not eating. Like my son's not sitting down in his chair properly. They're laughing. Water's getting spilled. And I'm like, you know, guys, I'm going to tell you something. I was just reading about a military boarding school for little boys who aren't well behaved. And it's like, oh no.
They right? sit right up.
Yeah. Like everybody kind of sits up in their chairs. And my youngest one, Nico, he's 5.
Yeah.
He couldn't care less. Daddy, like whatever. I got you wrapped around my finger. My middle boy's Theo. He's very emotional. And he kind of immediately starts crying as soon as I start talking about this military boarding school and how it works. And you go away for 10 months and you have your own bunk bed and there's 3 or 4 other boys in there with you and you have a little closet to put your things in. And my oldest boy doesn't say a word.
Mm-hmm.
Eats his food diligently, takes his plate, puts it in the kitchen, goes around, taps his brother and says, come on, boys, let's go upstairs. Let's get ready for bed. And I look at my wife and I'm like, wow. And I go, I'm going to listen to what they're saying up there. So I walk up to where the 3 of them, because my oldest boy is now helping the 5-year-old get ready for bed. And I go, good. 7-year-old's crying still. And I'm listening to them talk. And Oscar says to them, guys, we might have a problem. I saw on daddy's computer, his tablet, that this place actually exists while they were making dinner. And they don't know that we saw it, but I think we really have to improve our behavior. And that night while I was reading them books, we have this like great bedtime routine. Where it's like, get ready, brush your teeth. I read them books. And then my wife actually like sings them a song.
That's very sweet.
Like, it would be a great, great. Like I wish I mean, I had a great bedtime routine. Thank you, mommy. But my, like this, the great bedtime routine, but you could tell like everybody was quite morose. It was very. And so after the songs, I went into their beds and I was like, buddy, like I would never be able to be without you for 10 months. Like, don't worry. And I explained about the podcast and what I was doing. And even still for like another week, it's always been a topic of conversation. And I don't know who would be more devastated, me or my kids, to not have them with me for 10 months. Like I've seen the videos for it, everything. I'm sure it's great and I'm sure it serves a purpose. But oh man, if I tell them that you're on the board of the school that
when you beat them, they're going to run in the other direction.
So just open up the site every once in a while, right? And scroll through the videos and stuff like that.
Well, no, it's a great story. And I'm the chair of the Board of Governors, Rubberland Academy. It's in Wellandport in the middle of Niagara, not too far from my place
in Niagara.
And when I was an MPP, I'd visit there and visit with the students and talk in their class. And when I retired, they asked me to go on the board, which I've enjoyed. But it is a game changer. So it's strictly boys. You're right. It's military inspired. So they're up at the crack of dawn, right? They're doing their laps, a lot of physical activity. No devices allowed. You've got to actually earn the right to go online or to call your parents. But what it does is it instills a lot of discipline. It instills self-respect and instills teamwork. And there's particular boys that are not served by our public school system. And this really helps give them a strong set of values and behaviors for success in life. And I'm really pleased to say that of our graduates, 100% go on to college, university, or a skilled trade. Or it turns life around. And you know, a lot of boys, like with ADHD, for example, they're getting left behind the public school system. And our program really helps to give them a much better path in life and parents are happy about.
Could you ever not have your daughters with you for 10 months out of the year?
Yeah, and it's a tough call for parents, right? Because they are, now they can earn leave and there's Christmas and such, but you've got to earn it, right? So it rewards good behavior. Yeah, I miss Miller and Maitland. They're aware of the school too, but they're happy it's only boys. there's no girls there. But sometimes, you know, you get in a situation where you know that this is best for your son. We actually had a dinner with some parents just the other night, some of the board members and the headmaster and I, and they were just so thankful. They said it's such a transformation of the son who was always on video games till 4 in the morning, maybe hanging out with the wrong crowd, smart kid, but barely scraping by in school. And now they see a totally different son as a result of the school.
Terrifying. Terrifying. I just like I would miss them so much.
Yeah, and you got good routine sometimes because of the way that God wired us, maybe the environment, what have you. Sometimes they lose their way. And sadly, the public school system for boys in that situation, and we do.
Yeah. Well, listen, thank you very much. This was so great.
My pleasure. We covered a lot of topics. For yeah. Good seeing you again.
Yeah.
Good hanging out in your den here, in your workout room and all that kind of stuff. But thank you for your leadership. Really appreciate the great advice that you give, leadership in the community. And we look forward to seeing you at the Reality Conference March.
Was it March 6th and 7th?
March 6th and 7th in Ottawa, realityconference.ca.
But you and I, we can play 2-on-1 against Magic Johnson.
That's what I was just thinking.
Whatever gets bigger, it's even good vibe.
You got some height. It'll give us a shot.
I'd still get a good first step.
Yeah.
Maybe we can score a basket.
Yes. I think we could take him for like at least a point.
Well, let's give it a shot, right? But I'm excited about seeing him. I think that to have that caliber speaker at our event, somebody who's not only a basketball legend, but very successful in real estate and business investment, inspiring speaker. So we'll see him on stage.
You know how much money he's worth? Do you know what he's worth?
I don't know.
$1.2 billion.
Well, there you go.
And you know the other guy you have? Damon John.
Damon John, yeah. That's on there. Yeah.
How much is he worth?
Okay, I'm going to say, you said 1.2 for Magic. I'll say, he's got FUBU, so he's done really well. I'll say same neighborhood.
No way. This is barely at the 500 mark. 350.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah. Well, it's not too bad.
No, it's still pretty good. Still pretty. I look forward to meeting them for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, last one. Michael Jordan. You know how much he's worth?
Okay, Magic's 1.2. Jordan, Air Jordans, all that Nike stuff. 4.5.
3. You're close. Okay. They're right there.
There we go.
It serves him. Like, you know what I mean? He was the best basketball player. He might as well be worth a lot more.
I'm a basketball fan. So any of those guys, I can, you know, like, try to figure out how they rank on the spectrum. But it is really cool to see them have success outside of the game. And that doesn't happen to everybody in sports. So learning from somebody like Magic Johnson about how to invest your money wisely, it's going to be great for our realtor members or fans of real estate.
Yeah. It's unfortunate you couldn't get Larry Bird on there because you mentioned earlier you were a Celtics fan.
Yeah.
I wonder what his net worth is.
So we actually looked into Larry Bird. He's not as much the speaker circuit. His personality is a bit
reserved, perhaps?
Reserved and a bit rough around the edges.
So I don't think he's up for the ranking, but he's probably back in Southwick, Indiana, still taking the three.
Mate, nursing his $5 million net worth.
Yikes, and the poor fella.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Great seeing you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you.